I'm Ben, the author of Through All Ten Store. In this podcast, I take us into the Mega Dungeon to interview veteran GMs about the tools and techniques they use to create and run Mega Dungeons, entire campaigns where the adventuring takes place in a single giant dungeon with hundreds of rooms spread out over many levels. I have so many questions to ask our GMs. Why run a Mega Dungeon campaign? How can you build a single adventure location so that it sustains excitement over more than 100 sessions? Mega Dungeons are huge. How do you even get started prepping them? To answer these questions and many more, I'm going to talk to the people who know best, the GMs with years of actual experience running amazing Mega Dungeon campaigns.
I'm delighted today to have Gus on the podcast with me. Gus is the author of Tomb Robbers of the Crystal Frontier, Broken Bastion, and Beneath the Moss Courts, among other things, as well as the author of the blog All Dead Generations and formerly the blog Dungeons of Signs. He is also a collaborator with me on the Bones of Contention review blog and has collaborated with me on my zine Through All Ten Store throughout the whole run. So we've been talking about games for a very long time, and I'm delighted to have you on the podcast to talk about your Mega Dungeon campaign, HMS Apollyon, as well as your thoughts on the genre. Could you tell me about your history running Mega Dungeon campaigns?
Yeah, I'm delighted to be here too. I'll start with that. Mega Dungeons are something that I only really learned about from the OSR. Before I was actually active, before I was part of Google Plus, writing my own blogs, one of the first blogs that really brought my interest back to playing RPGs after not doing so for many years was Patrick Wetmore's Henchman Abuse, which is his play reports and some of his ideas as he's creating Anomalous Subsurface Environment, ASC, which I think is one of the best Mega Dungeons out there, and probably one of the best products that sort of the OSR has put together. So that kind of is what got me back into play. And I started running ASC with a group of people at home at my kitchen table, at someone else's kitchen table, really. And that went on for a while. And toward midway through that, I started writing Dungeons of Signs about campaign. The first half year of Dungeons of Signs was just all about Anomalous Subsurface Environment. Then I found G+, I don't exactly remember how, and quickly started playing in games and ultimately running games. And the game that I primarily ran on G+ was HMS Apollyon, which was a mega dungeon set in an enormous 5-mile-long cruise ship that had been abandoned, lost at sea somewhere, not quite where it came from, for an unknown length of time. And the survivors of the crew and the passengers and their children or grandchildren or whatever were sort of struggling to exist in this huge mega dungeon. That really became my dungeon for many years until maybe 2018, I think, 2019 even. Wait, right around when G+ went dark, I was still running occasional games of HMS Apollyon. It was an interesting experiment in mega dungeons. Because it was never all mapped out. I don't have a drawing or a map or really a description of every part of the ship. It was all done just in these little nodes, these little locations.
Could you talk about that? That is, how did you think about designing different regions or nodes for exploration? Maybe you could say a little bit about how that worked. Was there a home base players were setting out from? Mm-hmm. And could you maybe give us a couple of examples?
So the HMS Apollyon was this sort of rusty, crumbling mass of Victorian or Art Nouveau ironwork, and it was all made out of orichalcum because you need a material that the walls are built out of that is not inherently valuable and that can't be cut through with a welding torch and dragged back to town. Because that was one of the main distinctions, I would say, about HMS Apollyon, and that was that there was nothing except dungeon. Like the whole campaign, there was no overworld, there was no real urban environment. There was a city called Sterntown, which was guarded and highly stratified, and there were some adventures that took place there. But it wasn't really different from the dungeon. You walk out the front gates and you're in the unknown maze, an underground maze, as Gygax would call it. And that was the first sort of experiment or pretense of Apollyon, because when I had been running ASC, what kept happening, and this happened again, I've run ASC a few times, and this always happens when you run ASC, and I don't know if it always happens when you run a mega dungeon that has an overworld. People go into the mega dungeon, they look around, something bad happens, and they say, hey, what else is there to do? They leave the mega dungeon, they go back to town, and they try to get elected to city council, or they develop an issue with the local crime boss and start machinations, and then they want to go to the mountains. And ASC is really well set up for that. ASC, the first book, is half this really fun science fantasy post-apocalyptic world, and it's really hard not to deal with that, not to engage with that. But so with HMS Apollyon, what I was trying to do was create a world dungeon where, yeah, I want to play a dungeon crawl game. So there's no way you're going to get to do a wilderness travel. There's no way you're going to get to engage in too much political role play, because all there is dungeon. And the most important thing for the town is that you are a scavenger, and your job, if you want to eat, is to go find things in that dungeon and bring them back to town. And that was another fun aspect of it, that the loot was not just gold and jewels and things. I think the first session, the big piece of loot was a copper cable spool. This is a weird one, but like when I was a kid, like cool hippies would have households and they'd have one of these spools as their kitchen table. It was just this giant kitchen table size spool with copper cable on it. And that was worth like 800 gold, because gold was very worthless on the Apollo. No one could do anything with gold, but copper you could run cables with, things like that. So it was kind of the copper thief, meth head, treasure hunter, scavenger game. And people seem to like that, because it really brought out the aspect of play where you're like, okay, I'm in this weird space. I'm looking around this fantastical space. I'm trying to get rich. What's valuable? And I think that's a lot of fun. I think that's a lot more fun than being just like, okay, I've rolled up the random treasure table and there's X thousands of copper pieces in a giant pile. So Apollyon was his sort of ruined spaces. And the first one that I ran was the abandoned power station. And then south of it along this main corridor was the mushroom farm, where a group of utopian idealists had attempted to create their own community some 10 years before and disappeared and been eaten by monsters. I think there was a giant zombie shark in there or something. And then the power station was a power station. And so the city was very interested in getting it back. And so the adventurers ran through there, and there were these weird crayfish dogs that could tear through walls. So that would be like one node. That was one node. I think it was like two levels, maybe 80 rooms total, 80 keep spaces total. A couple sheets of graph paper.
So pretty big. Like a node.
Yeah, that
big.
Was a node. Could be. Some nodes were tiny, other nodes that were really small. And they were connected at first just by, okay, you undog a hatch and you walked into a new space. Beyond the, there was a giant junk pile in the center of the vault that was beyond the power station and the mushroom farm. If you walked down a straight main corridor, you could go there without any trouble. And in that junk pile, there was a town of weird little fishmen that, you know, would blow mutagenic poison dust on you. And eventually they became friendly with the weird mutant little fishman, and I had to create a weird little mutant fishman character class. Because that's what mega dungeons do if they didn't run well, is they really just create these strange interactions.
This whole premise of setting the civilization inside the dungeon itself, you know what, it is amazing. And it really reminds me of the Metamorphosis Alpha and the Generation Ship, that brief foray into science fantasy dungeoneer, where similarly, I mean, there was the thought of being, as it were, embedded in what perhaps your players didn't know was a dungeon, but which ultimately was just an enormous dungeon.
And I think Metamorphosis Alpha, which is not something I knew a great deal about when I started running it, but my main actual inspiration from it was this comic book, this 2080 comic book from the early aughts called Leviathan, which is effectively, that is the entire setup. It's that giant cruise ship that's 10 times the size of the Titanic, built in Victorian England, and it gets sucked into hell because the evil man that was creating it decided to power it with the soul of Moloch, the arch devil. and that's the setting. But yeah, I think that was a generation shift story. That was the sort of, oh, you're trapped in the stars and something went wrong and you never made it to the planet.
Yeah. I also learned, I did learn from you about Treasure, although I've certainly never taken it to the extent you have. I have always attempted to avoid, I think ever since I started reading your stuff, giving gold coins or even too much jewelry or whatever on the whole. And instead, it's got to be fabulous furniture and things that are both interesting to describe, difficult to extract, and something that the players can feel the allure of in some way.
Yeah, I think treasure is a really fascinating aspect of not just Mega Dungeon play, but especially Mega Dungeon play, because Mega Dungeon play is, it's pure dungeon crawl. It really works best if the means of advancement is purely treasure, XP for GP. And yet at the same time, treasure is one of those kind of real cornerstones of fantasy RPGs that we don't see a lot of development of. And I think it's sad because when I was a kid, one of the things that I remember a lot thinking about, not just as part of as playing D&D, but like I remember that in the early 80s, late 70s, there was the Tutankhamun's tomb exhibit was moving around the United States. And you could go see it. And you could go see the famous gold mask with the lapis lazuli on it. It's this amazing piece of art that's just solid gold. And I think that's really an aspect of D&D. And I've talked to other people who grew up interested in fantasy and excited by fantasy. And one of my closest friends, she says that she started reading fantasy books because of the jewels and because of the descriptions of like Smaug's treasure hoard and all that stuff. And yet when you look at D&D, it tells you how much treasure should be in a dungeon. So what do we think the speed you should level at is? And other than that, it's just like, what should an individual monster have? But it doesn't go into detail. And there's this great part in the Indie Dungeon Master's Guide. I think it's probably one of Gygax's best paragraphs where he talks about what does treasure look like? And there are these two large ogres that live in a hole and they have a treasure hoard. And the treasure hoard is not, he rolls the value for it or says he rolls the value for it. I think, I can't remember. He might just launch into what it is, but it's like, dirty furs and some helmets and some oak furniture. Like it is exactly that kind of random hoard of you're rummaging through someone's house for their valuables. And I like that. I think it really brings something out. It creates wonder or can create wonder. And at a certain point, that's the goal, right? Otherwise, you're just looking at a spreadsheet and rolling dice. If you're not telling, I won't say you're telling a story because you're not telling a story, but you're describing things. And if you can't get people to buy into that description and get excited about that description, it's not going to be a great game. Dark Souls will do it better. Yeah.
How did the Apollyon campaign develop over time?
It was actually like multiple campaigns. I think people get to about fifth or seventh level. Then I'd need to take a break. Something would happen. Like I'd have huge work thing. I'd be like, I can't do this anymore. I need to spend all my time working, doing fantasy. I'd stop doing it for a few months and we could bring different people would come back or someone else's, some key person in the campaign wander off and it would start a different campaign. And the other thing that happened was at that time, it started on Google+. And Google+, from the period of maybe 2010 to when it ended in 2019, to me at least, and I know there's some contention about this, blah, blah, blah. But it really was where the OSR was happening. And you saw a blog you liked, there was like 95% chance you could talk to that blog or someone who knew them on Google+. Someone who played their games on Google+. And you could just say, hey, I was playing such and such and I saw this blog post and I had a question. And that person would pop up and be like, oh, this is what I was thinking. And it was great. And one of the things that was happening during that time was the idea of online play was really starting. That's kind of what Google+ did. It was the beginning of online play, which is funny because that ultimately became the way we all do our job meetings and our going to school and everything a few years later. But it was Google+ game, it was a ConstantCon game. And that meant you had people coming from all these other games. Some people were playing like 6-8 games a week, I think. Like more games than there were days. And that was really exciting. I could never keep up with that level of schedule. But I was running once a week or once every other week. And you started getting characters that would just like waltz in who had just been into Gamma World and had like a blaster rifle that did 8d8 damage.
For those who don't know, let me just say what Flail Snails was. Was a kind of collective endeavor organized primarily through Google Plus, whereby protocols were written so that people could take their PCs from one game and drop them into another game. And there was a kind of open table scheduling roughly that went with that. And so you had characters moving from wildly different games into other games. You're describing some of the difficulties that this wonderful experiment produced.
Yeah, and I'm sure I was part of it too, because firearms were pretty common in my game. They weren't very effective. Oh, you have a rifle, it does 1d6. But it became difficult to run a game after fifth or sixth level, precisely because you had these characters like, every one of my stats is 21 now because I drank the blood of some god in game. And it was like, okay, I don't even know what I'm dealing with. I don't know how to structure this. And sure, I could tell that guy, like, nah, here it isn't. Your stats are all 14s. But you don't really want to do that to someone, right? They earned those 21s. But at a certain point, it breaks down because Constagon and Flail Snails really encourage these kind of over-the-top sort of scenarios. So I started running it as just a thing in and of itself. And I did that a couple times. There was one campaign that was like, rich fops who were part of the first class, which was like the nobility of the town. And they were like exploring the deck, which was, no one else had been outside in like the whole 4 years playing before that. But these guys got to wander around on the deck, which is also kind of a ruin. Like deal with like their creepy neighbor and a loose peacock bear, which is like an owl bear, but a peacock with six legs. Anyways, it was a lot of stuff like that. And they weren't looking for treasure. They were looking for curios to bring back, or like photographs of themselves in cool vistas. So it became a bunch of different little campaigns. We had campaigns where you were climbing down this giant light well, another one where they were the fops and things like that. So it went all over the place. And that was one of the fun things about it, the way this ship started taking form in my mind and in the minds of my players too, I think, over time.
You've written a fair bit about a play style that you call the dungeon crawl or procedural dungeon crawl. And one of the things that you talk about in that context is about space, something you call orienteering. I was hearing echoes of that in what you were just saying about Apollyon. Do you maybe want to talk a little bit about that?
So there's this line in the 1950s book of prose poetry, Call Me Ishmael, that starts with, I consider the first question of a man born in America, something like that, to be the question of space. And I really think the question of space is, to me, the fundamental sort of thing that you're dealing with when you're dealing with a dungeon. A dungeon is this fantastical space. It's this made-up space. And the core of the game is moving through this space as if you were walking through a cave or an abandoned movie theater or someone's house and noticing the things in it and experiencing that. And obviously there's dangers in there and there's risks in there and there's rewards in there. It's not just any space. It's a space for adventure. It's a space for wonder and dying horribly in a hole and finding a magic sword. But the weird thing about D&D or about RPGs that's different to me from, say, all the other genres where we see fantasy, where we see imaginary spaces, is that when you're running a dungeon, you don't get to elide anything. You don't get to be like, and then they wandered through mazy halls for days until they ran out of water. Because your player's going to be like, nope, we didn't run out of water. We were looking for water the whole time. I've got a 4 survival skill, so let me roll that. No, we have all the water we want. And you're like, but no, this is just a segue. You need to go. It doesn't work. Like, you have to have the whole space. And so to do that, you need to let go of certain things that you might have seen in a movie or read in a fantasy novel. And instead, you have to be like, all right, this is not about impressions. Like, everything is mapped out in 10-foot squares. And you can go right, you can go left. There's a door, you can open the door. And that's the heart of the playstyle. You can do those other things. You can have that kind of vague jaunt or impressionistic kind of view of the world in other playstyles or in other venues, even in that play style, wilderness adventures. That happens a lot in wilderness adventure. No one is drawing a 10 by 10 map of even a city or a county. Like a hex is 6 miles across usually. Have you ever walked 6 miles? You see a lot of stuff because that takes you like an hour. And it never does when you do a hex crawl. It's like, this hex is forest. Maybe you have one encounter and it's like squirrels. You saw squirrels. Okay, not on next hex. But you can't do that in a dungeon. So a dungeon has to be about space. And to make that space interesting, to make that space fun, there has to be some risk associated with it. It's not just, okay, you walk 10 feet, the ground is mossy. Next 10 feet, okay, the ground is still mossy. There have to be things putting pressure on the players where they get to make decisions, but they get to sort of evaluate the risk of, oh, have we gone too deep? Do we need to find another way out? Are we almost out of equipment? Can we get into another fight? Do we need more torches? Can we carry all this fancy furniture we found? Is that safe? Or do we try to like lock the door and come back for it later? And those are the kind of decisions I like because they make that exploration. They make that looking around this sort of crumbled mansion or whatever exciting. And I don't know if you've ever done an urban exploration, breaking into old abandoned places, but there is something really wondrous about being in these abandoned spaces or these relatively unknown spaces. Like you're seeing something other people don't get to see, and you find these sort of echoes from the past or these sort of visually stunning things. And part of that is like decay or things that were once normal but aren't anymore.
I think you're combining two things which go together great. That is, one is a sense of finding your way around and navigating a space as a kind of choice space. And it wouldn't matter as a choice space, except that you're under pressure. And you're under pressure because this is a space for adventure, it's the space of peril, it's high stakes. And so the kind of finding your way around and developing that kind of knowledge and intuitive sense of a space and ability to make meaningful choices. And that means to reason about things partly in those kind of spatial terms is crucial to the dungeon crawl in this play style that Apollyon was designed to relentlessly focus people on. And then I think you're combining that with something else. What makes that extra fun, or you're tapping into, that is the idea that when you're finding your way around the space, you're also coming to acquire this kind of evocative, rich sense of place that has these elements of wonder, the hauntings of the past, some aesthetics of crumbling and decaying, or of this or that, depending on what it is. This kind of thing is just an incredibly strong experience for me. I have done some urban exploration, but I also think just getting to know the ins and outs of a city also is very rich, and it is about finding your way around, and it is about going left or right, but it's also about these kind of sights and sounds and the aesthetics of place. And when it's all working well, those two things come together. And I do think in your dungeon design, you have, like, this is kind of a superpower of yours or something. Like, I think you have a really rich sense of place that just kind of comes through. You're able to communicate just very directly. I mean, it's part of the reason, actually, I like your published stuff so much.
I think that's it. That was much more eloquent than what I was rambling about. But yeah, I do think that's really interesting, because I think one of the problems that we deal with right now with old school play or with classic play or dungeon crawls, or even with RPGs in general, like I find this when I read a lot of 5e stuff too, because I do read 5e stuff. There is a bit of a poverty of imagination when it comes to what an RPG is supposed to look like, what RPG fantasy is supposed to look like. And that's not to say that many people aren't doing really creative things and aren't really tapping into just cool stuff. Let's just call it cool stuff. I think it's sad, because when I was reading B2, I was thinking about B2 for some reason a few days ago. And you look at B2 and its descriptions are really meh. By contemporary standards, they're pretty meh. They're short. They're super short. It is a cave. Okay, it's a cave. I feel like in the 1970s or 1980s, and when I was first playing B2, because B2 was the first adventure I played.
And B2 is the Keep on the Borderlands,
right?
Classic module.
Classic cowboy story of murdering strangers and taking their stuff by kicking in their doors of their homes, which I feel like that's part of D&D. I don't know. It's its own thing. That's a whole different discussion. And I'm okay with it some of the time. It just sometimes it hurts a little. But you look at these early descriptions and they're very simple, not just B2, but all the early Gygax modules, even Cavendish's Thracia, which I think is a real turning point in design, or it's really a touchstone for design. And there's a reason that it's frequently referred to as one of the great adventures of the early period. But all these adventures, they're focusing on this kind of really simple understanding of fantasy. But it's drawn from all these sources. It's drawn from Conan and Tolkien. But to my eyes now in 2023, this stuff is just trite. If you are scrolling through Instagram and those horrible ads for video games pop up, they all look like a Gygax adventure. It's, oh, there's goblins and orcs and they're green and you are an elf. And it's that would have been really cool in 1974. It's not really cool anymore. It's a scam to make you buy loot crates. And I don't want to run my games like that because...
Life is short,
yeah. And there's so much more cool stuff out there. Even history is really cool. One of the things I've been doing that I've been thinking about, oh, I want to write a new adventure. Okay, whatever. I've been looking at the UNESCO list of World Heritage Sites. There's hundreds of cool things from the past you can look at, and they're weird. Like, my favorite is like a garden folly that some dude built in the 19th century who was like a rich lawyer in France, and he built these like grottos for his intellectual salons and orgies, and he decorated them with seashells and fountains and stuff like that. And then he died, and he left it to his kids, and they were like, we don't want the orgy grottos. You know, we'll take the rest of the absurd wealth. Just screw those orgy grottos. So, you know, the silver nip statues disappeared. But in the 19th century, some people like found this place and they're like, oh, what is this place? What is this? These mysterious caves. Someone has created these. And they asked the local farmers, hey, what's with this stuff? And they're like, you know, they weren't like, oh, it was this guy 2 generations ago, 3 generations ago built this like orgy pit. They were like, oh, that's ancient. The Druids practiced their rituals there in the time of Caesar. No, it's 50 years old. And I love that kind of thing. Like you could, that is just like a great dungeon idea. And there's hundreds of these. The UNESCO, go look at Wikipedia, read the UNESCO list. It's amazing. But yeah, it's not hard to find cool new ideas. And I feel like when I read a lot of people's work, it makes me really sad because they're taking time. They're taking effort. It takes a long time to key a dungeon, even a 10-room dungeon. It's not like something you do in an evening unless you're doing it for yourself. But to write it out where you publish it, it takes a lot of time. And people are like, oh, I don't want to do anything that goes too far from like orcs and all. The only distinction is maybe these orcs, they grow a lot of weird mushrooms. Okay, you can go beyond that. And you don't have to be afraid to go beyond. And I feel like so many people are writing adventures. I don't want to go outside the bounds that were set in the late 70s, the early 80s, because maybe I'll do something wrong. Yeah, you'll do something wrong. 90% of adventures aren't great. 90% of the adventures I write aren't great. But at least you'll be trying. At least you'll be learning something. At least you'll be having fun.
I'll go on record agreeing with you about that. Maybe it's a good segue from that to ask, you also do a fair bit of reviewing of Mega Dungeons, among other things. I have the sense that you've read a bunch of Mega Dungeons, and I also have the sense that you think a lot of them aren't that great. And so my question is, why is it hard to write a Mega Dungeon?
I think that the problem there is fundamentally the distinction between running your own game and writing something for other people. Because I don't think I could make a Polyon into something that I could hand to you even. And we're pretty much on the same page. A Mega Dungeon really is individual private world of people at the table. And you can look at some of the more detailed and impressive Mega Dungeons. I've been reading Ardenvol lately, and I've been trying to write a review of Ardenvol for months now, but it's been a real busy time anyways. Ardenvol is astonishingly good. Could I run Ardenvol? I don't know. I know the 3D6 Down the Line guys podcast or a YouTube channel are running it. They seem to have fun. I listened to a few of them. Sounds like a good game. But when I read it, and this thing is 1,000 pages long, and that's the first problem with writing a good mega dungeon. I don't have time to write 1,000 pages It took them 10 years to write this thing, and it's worth a look, and I salute them, and it is an excellent Mega Dungeon. It may be one of the best ones out there. It is one of the best ones out there. I don't know whether it's the best one, but it's also like you need to read 100 pages before you even get to the keys. There's 50 pages of factions in there. And it's incredibly complex. It's incredibly detailed. The keys are really well done. The keys are actually well done. They're just huge because there's so many different angles that things are coming into. And that's the problem with the Mega Dungeon. Because when you write a dungeon, you say you've got like 50 rooms. You want to have a few factions. You want to have a few things going on, some levers that the characters can pull, some different cool things they can discover. And those things should interact with each other. That's going to be a bit because you have to have everything interact with each other. And you have to know the mushroom people feel this way about the slug people because the slug people eat them, obviously. And then the undead paladins hate them both or love them both. Like, you have to have these relationship maps and the players come in and they bumble in and they destroy everything and they make enemies and they make friends. When you have a mega dungeon, you have three to five factions per level and you have 10 levels. So you have to have interactions with. Just to keep that in your head and to put it down on paper, apparently we know it takes 100 pages. And there's not a lot of people who have time to read 100 pages to run a game of D&D. So that's the first thing that makes writing Mega Dungeons hard. Is all that stuff, all those sort of faction relationships and details and histories and secrets that you want in a dungeon, any dungeon.
That make it come alive.
Right, yeah. They're bigger. And there's more of them in a mega dungeon. It's mega. So, but that's a lot of work. And dungeons are already more work than writing rules. So that's one problem. And then the other problem is translating all these things which you thought of. And they can fit in your head because they're structured pretty well intuitively when you're thinking of them in your own mind. But it's really hard to get that on the page in a way someone else can use. I can remember that the fungus people don't like the slug people, and I can remember the history of that and the details and the clues that would indicate to the PCs where the giant salt blocks are or whatever. But to put that down into writing in a way that another person can understand, pick up, use in play is really hard. And it takes up a lot of space.
I also feel like your description of how Apollyon like grew and that was over time.
Yeah, it was like 10 years.
You came to have ideas about different spaces of the ship and how they were related, and your players did, and they came to have a sense of place, and they had memories of the history of the different things, and that emerged. It wasn't like you sat down and wrote 1,000 pages. It's like emerged in bits and pieces and through experience and through a sense of place and lived
and running a game. Yeah.
And running a game. Yeah, that's... Right.
But even then, to turn that into a product, to turn that into something for other people is incredibly hard. Because how do you start to tell them? Do you start with how I started? Do you say, okay, here's the map I drew on the train coming home because I said I was going to run a game and 14 people signed up. Holy crap. I didn't know that would happen because that's what happened. So I'm drawing this dungeon map coming home on the commuter train. And you know, you can't really start a mega dungeon by just handing someone a map. But how do you know what information you're supposed to give people? What details and when? Because people want to know, referees particularly, like they like digging in. They like learning those secrets. They like learning those histories. Of course, you want to make sure that those histories are also all playable and important, because the other way to do it, just like with the 100 pages of history and detail starting your book, that doesn't work either, because who wants to read that? And then there's the third way that most mega dungeons actually do it, which is just, okay, I'll just put the minimum amount of everything in there, which is fine. But like, I can draw a big map and write 12 goblins on the map for several rooms, 4 goblins and like silver goblet. And when you do that, that's the other thing about mega dungeons, right? A lot of the time, mega dungeons are best if they refer back to something else. If all the history and all the details about, oh, the monsters do this and this is their ecology and these guys hate these guys, if all that's in the monster manual, you don't have to put it in your dungeon. Whereas if it's not, you got to put it in your dungeon. And that takes up more space. You have to put a monster manual in there. And sure, you break it up into the keys, individual keys, but that's still pages and pages of information that you're giving to the referee to run. So if you can refer back to the system, or you can refer back to their expectations. If I tell you 12 goblins are in a room, I suspect 80%, 95%, anyone who thinks they can GM a game of fantasy RPGs can tell me what's going on in a room with 8 goblins in it. And they can tell me what goblins look like and what they're doing and their funny high-pitched voices and all that. It's really easy. But if I tell them that 4 fancy velociraptors, velociraptor nobility are in there, maybe they can do that because they know what a velociraptor is. They've seen Jurassic Park and they just give it a monocle. But the weirder it gets, the more information you have to give to that referee. And to make a game that is interesting now, to make a dungeon that is interesting now in 2023, you got to do something that doesn't look like a bad mobile game. So anyways, that's my take on why Mega Dungeons is kind of not that great.
Maybe this is a good place to wrap up our conversation.
I can keep talking. I'll pour myself a drink of whiskey and I can go until your son comes up. I'll interview you about Old Tom's Door.
Yeah, sure. You could do that. I could explain secretly how in a way it's a mega dungeon. That's one thing.
I know it's a mega dungeon. It's a nodal mega dungeon. It is the same as the Apollyon.
It is. It's basically the same as the Apollyon.
It's the way to write mega dungeon. And I think you have figured out the secret of how to publish it.
Little bits.
You just need the time to do more levels. Just Pat Wetmore figured out the secret of how to publish his giant mega dungeon. One book every 2 years, then he got 2 out and he was like, I got the shit.
So Gus, if people wanted to learn more about you and your work, where should they go to find you?
I think the best way to look at what I'm working on is Old Dead Generations. I haven't updated in months. I don't update that often. Hopefully I'll get back to a little bit soon. I'm finished another adventure right now for Crystal Frontier, which is the setting I'm working on right now. The other place, if you want to hear more about Apollyon, you go to Dungeons of Signs. It's an old blog. I haven't updated it for years. It just ran its course and I got tired of the OSR scene as it was in 2018, I think. But you can look there for hundreds of posts on Apollyon. If you're just like, oh, I want to read this guy's adventures, I have a little my personal imprint or whatever, Rat King Productions. Everything's published on DTRPG. It's all PDFs.
And I will include links to all of those things in the show notes.
Oh, one last thing. You could totally buy some Old Town Store stuff too, because I have drawn the maps for it. And also I wrote an adventure for Old Town Store called Oath's Courts, which I like a fair bit. It's fun. There's pirates. They're horrible.
Yeah.
There's bloggers. There's also horrible.
I'm running it for my face-to-face group right now, actually.
So do they hate the pirates or the lawyers more? Which are worse?
They definitely hate the lawyers. They're afraid of the pirates, rightly.